What happens when the line between reality and the supernatural begins to blur? For the Lutz family, it wasn't just a haunted house. It was an experience that would define fear for generations to come. But was it all true or a carefully constructed tale designed to enthrall and profit? In this episode, we navigate the infamous Amityville Horror, one of the most debated supernatural cases in history. The Lutz family's experiences at 112 Ocean Avenue sparked a phenomenon that intertwined horror, tragedy, and skepticism. We will uncover new dimensions of the story, including hidden testimonies, lesser-known investigations, and overlooked details that cast light on both the haunting and the alleged hoax. Prepare for a journey into one of America's most enduring mysteries, where the truth might be scarier than fiction. This is Scarlet Tavern. All right.
Back at it.
So, the Lutz family. Just so everybody knows, we will be talking shit about the Lutz family and the Warrens and all of that because this is all a hoax. None of this really happened to them. This is...
spoiler alert.
Yeah, this is just a piece of shit. So, the Lutz family's decision to move into 112 Ocean Avenue, a house already shrouded in infamy, seemed bold, if not reckless. Behind the iconic Dutch colonial facade, however, lay a sinister story waiting to entwine itself with their lives. Their move was not just about transitioning to a bigger home, but also about navigating personal challenges, financial stress, and the emotional weight of blending families. From the very beginning, the shadows in the house began to seep into every aspect of their lives, gradually transforming their dream home into a psychological and supernatural battleground. The house represented an opportunity for George and Kathy to solidify their new family unit. Its spacious rooms, serene riverside location, and luxurious amenities, including a heated pool and boathouse, seemed ideal for their family of five. For George, the house symbolized a step toward financial success despite its daunting price tag. For Kathy, it represented stability for her children after a previous marriage and a chance to build new memories. The price of $80,000, which would be the equivalent of $469,134 today.
That is insane.
Was a bargain for the size and location, but still stretched the Lutz's family resources thin. The knowledge of the DeFeo murders hung over the sale like a shadow, with a realtor openly disclosing the property's violent history. George, a pragmatic man, dismissed the concerns, viewing the tragedy as irrelevant to their future. Kathy, however, hesitated. She later admitted that a part of her felt the house was wrong from the moment she walked through the door.
I honestly can see George's point of view. I mean, it's morbid, it's macabre to move into a house like that, especially so soon after.
Yeah, it was like a year.
Yeah.
Like, legit a year from when the murders happened.
Yeah, but I can see where he's coming from. You know, it's like, I'm not going to kill my family in here, so we're fine. Yeah. I mean, I would, I'm telling you right now, if I had an opportunity for $80,000 for a price like this with a boathouse, which means it's on a waterfront, and a heated pool, I'm taking that
house. $500,000 house.
Today.
Today, but still.
And people wonder why us millennials and Gen Z and that don't want to buy a house.
Yeah, for that price, that's also factoring in the fact that the New York, Long Island real estate property price is just like skyrocketing.
So that actually is probably, it's probably even more than what the, like, $500,000. That's probably. Oh,
yeah. I think the last person, the current owner of the house, I think that he disclosed he paid like almost $2 million for it.
Yeah, because that's just what inflation, it inflated to today.
Inflation and the higher than average property taxes, that's just for
that. Well, no, I didn't even do property taxes or anything. Oh, okay. That's $80,000 is what they paid for it. That $500,000 was just translated. That isn't property tax, nothing. It's just what it is today.
I don't know if I paid that much for a house. I mean, but still, I mean, again, probably from George's mind, he thought he was probably getting a bargain. He's getting this big ass house, he's getting a boathouse, and he's getting a pool. I mean, and from what I understand, George was just like basically a carpenter or a handyman kind of person. This is probably a palace to him.
Yeah.
Okay, so we look at going back all the way to 2015. It sold, the highest it sold in 2015 was 611,000. 2016, it sold for 830,000. 2017, it dropped back down to 622. 2018, the highest was like 657. 2019, it looks like it was about 680. 2020, it went back up to 800,000, about 850,000. Today, right now, February 2025, it's 1.1 million.
Okay.
And keep in mind, it's no longer 112 Ocean Avenue.
Yeah, they
it's 108.
Now, I think they not only changed the street name.
No.
It's just the house number. It's 108.
They changed it because
people kept showing up.
Exactly. So it was the owners after the Lutz. I don't think it was the Lutz after the Lutzes. It was after the Amityville Horror movie came out. There were people coming to the house day and night. Didn't matter the hours, nothing. Either destroying the property or knocking on the door saying, hey, we want to see this haunted house.
And I believe also the one of the owners, not the one of the owners at one point, he did a complete facade remodeling of it. So it doesn't even have that ominous, like it's like, style windows that it looks like it's like it got an evil face on it. It's just whatever.
So you were talking about the property taxes in 2017. The property taxes were $28,000, and it's gone up since then.
Yeah,
the tax assessment has gone down. It's $6,900, but
one wonders why everyone leaves New York.
It's it's $1.1 million right now. According to Zillow, it's obviously off the market. But I mean, it's a nice house. It's got a quarter acre, sitting on a quarter acre.
Yeah.
It is 3,600 square feet, 5 beds, 4 baths. That's huge for New York.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
that's
again,
big, especially, I mean, this is Amityville.
I mean, I've obviously never been there, but if I remember correctly, Amityville and this part is like more of the, not rural part, but it's not the congested Nassau County part of Long Island that's closer to the city. This one's a little bit more further into the isle, into the center of the Long Island. Yeah, it's
right there.
Yeah, it's down by the southern coast. It's a little bit. It's a bit.
It's by Massapequa.
Yeah, that's money out there.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, they're right on that water. It's the Great South Bay is what it sits on. Which the Great South Bay obviously goes right into the ocean, right into the Atlantic. So, it just kind of, there's a little bit of a landmass there that it kind of dips into that they can basically drive the boat from there, go around that landmass and right into the Atlantic. So yeah, there's the property values. Thank you, Zillow. All right. So some of the Lutz's friends congratulated them on securing such prime property at a low cost, while others express concern about the murders. A few of Kathy's Catholic friends urged her to have the house blessed before moving in, a suggestion that would prove to have unforeseen consequences.
That actually was pretty typical back then in Catholic households. Oh, yeah. Local parish priest bless your home. It's a nice little housewarming gift, a way to welcome you into the community.
Yeah.
Married for just over a year, George and Kathy were still learning how to navigate their relationship while parenting three children together. George, disciplined and detail-oriented due to his military background, approached family life with structure and order. And he was a Marine that served in Vietnam. So he saw some shit.
Oh, yeah.
So
which is probably why when he heard about there were people killed in his house, it's like, cool, I lost five guys in my unit in the foxhole next
to me. Cool, I killed 30 with my bare hands. Again, yeah. Marines in Vietnam were in the shit.
K-Sung, yeah.
Like Army, Army was doing stuff too. But again, as we saw with John Leonard Orr, there was also some people that weren't doing stuff.
But he joined the Air Force during Vietnam. Yes, they definitely.
But they were mostly doing transport stuff. Yeah. Air Force was.
Yeah.
But the Marines were in the thick of it.
Yeah. K-Sung, the Marine station at the U.S. Embassy during the Tet Offensive.
Yeah. So. I don't know where exactly he was stationed. That's something I can probably find out. But yeah, so
I'm sure when that realtor was like, people have died here, and he'd be like, yeah. And?
Okay.
He's like, there may be a demon here. It's like, we'll probably get along.
Like, listen, you know how many demons are inside my head right now? Especially me at home. Kathy, a warm and nurturing mother, often found herself mediating between George and the children. George's attempts to establish authority in the household were met with resistance, particularly from Daniel, Kathy's oldest son. Daniel later described George as both controlling and distant, characteristics that worsened as tensions in the house escalated.
You're not my real dad.
Yeah. You're not my dad. Boy, I'm your daddy now. The Lutzes quickly realized that the home's maintenance and property taxes added a significant financial burden to their lives. George's surveying business was already struggling, and the cost of owning such a large home began to take a toll on the family's budget. These financial strains created a foundation of stress that skeptics later argued could have fueled the haunting narrative. To save money, George took on some of the home repairs and maintenance himself, often working late into the night. His exhaustion and preoccupation with finances led to a noticeable withdrawal from family activities, leaving Kathy to manage much of the household herself.
Another thing that, again, this is just a sign of the times. Kathy was obviously divorced, but she was also Catholic. George was a Protestant, and apparently there was a lot of, like, Kathy's Catholic friends and family were like, how could you marry a Protestant?
Yeah, that was a big thing back then.
It was getting better, but yeah, it was still definitely a thing.
Okay, so Kathy described feeling an oppressive weight the moment she entered the house, particularly on the second floor where the DeFeo murders had occurred. Visitors later echoed these sentiments, noting that certain areas, especially the upstairs bedrooms, felt unnaturally cold and claustrophobic. George, a self-described skeptic, the Marine, of course he is, initially dismissed the idea of supernatural energy, but admitted that the house had a different feel compared to any place he had lived before. In the first days after moving in, the family began noticing small unexplained occurrences that were easy to overlook individually, but unsettling when considered collectively. Footsteps echoed in the halls at night, even though everyone was accounted for. Doors opened and closed on their own, often slamming with enough force to wake the family. Certain rooms remained inexplicably cold no matter how high the thermostat was set. George described the basement as being colder than the rest of the house, even in the middle of summer. Harry, the family's Labrador Retriever, displayed extreme agitation, barking and whining whenever tied outside or brought near the house. On one occasion, the dog was found in a frantic state, having nearly strangled itself trying to escape its leash. George became obsessed with keeping the fireplace lit, spending hours each day feeding the flames. Despite his efforts, he claimed that the house never felt warm. He later suggested that the fireplace was connected to the house's malevolent energy, though he couldn't explain why he felt that way. As George's preoccupation with the fireplace grew, he began isolating himself from the family, often snapping at Kathy and the children when interrupted. George began waking up at exactly 3:15 a.m. each night, the time believed to correspond with the DeFeo murders. He initially dismissed it as his internal clock adjusting to a new schedule, but the consistency of the timing became harder to ignore. During these wake-ups, he often reported hearing phantom sounds, whispers, faint cries, and the distant echo of gunshots. Fuck, the neighbors can't hear the gunshots, but the dude that lives in the house the year later can.
Yeah.
How do we know? Half of everything he's saying, just from friends and everybody I know in the military, I'm like, this sounds like PTSD from combat. Yeah.
So I'm not finding the article that I obviously had about him serving in the military, so I don't know. But it could be the case.
PTSD?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean...
Well, no, I'm not finding the article that... Because of... That I... So it did. So he did. I found it. But it does, I can't find what...
Doesn't say where he served?
Well, I mean, technically, all records just say he served during Vietnam. They don't necessarily say he served in Vietnam.
Yeah, it says... George Lutz was a former Marine who said he served in Vietnam.
But we know we can trust his word.
Yeah.
Kathy began waking up with scratches and bruises on her arms and legs, despite having no memory of injuring herself. On one occasion, she discovered three deep welts across her back, a detail that some later associated with a mocking symbol of the Holy Trinity.
That's a bit of a leap. Yeah. This is coming from a lapsed Catholic who went to Catholic schools all his life.
I mean, was she, what's his name from Da Vinci Code?
Oh, yeah.
Who was it that played him?
Tom Hanks?
No, the one that beat himself.
Oh, Paul Bettany.
Yeah, Paul Bettany in the Da Vinci Code.
That was
Paul Bettany, the one that flayed himself, the albino.
Okay, I need to rewatch the Da Vinci Code.
That's Paul Bettany. He looks weird because they made him albino.
Well, that's how the character was.
Yeah. So, but that was him that was flailing himself. Yeah. Kathy reported feeling nauseous and dizzy in certain parts of the house, particularly near the red room in the basement. So don't go there. These symptoms often disappear the moment she stepped outside.
Imagine, that's just like a doctor's like, doctor, it hurts when I move my arm. Well, quit doing
that. Stop moving your fucking arm.
I get so scared when I go into this room. Well, stop going in there.
Kathy experienced vivid dreams in which she saw the murders through the eyes of Ronald DeFeo Jr. In one particularly haunting dream, she envisioned herself standing over the DeFeo children's beds, mirroring their final positions. Okay, so I want to preface everything that we're joking about by saying, I personally believe in spirits and ghosts and hauntings and all of that. I don't believe in this.
No. There's a lot of fucked up shit that happened in the background of this, but this is
a cry for attention and fame. Remember, they were dead ass broke.
Yeah. George gambled and he lost. He thought, I got a great deal. George, we don't have a lot of money to begin with. Why are you buying this house? It'll be great. George, your business is already failing. Why are we buying this house?
And guess what? In the 70s, surveying jobs, like surveying business, was not huge. Nobody really had the money at this point to build houses or do a lot of construction, which is what surveying does. So not until
he would go into like New Jersey, he might have, because there was a big housing boom because everybody was leaving New York City
because it was so expensive.
Houses were being built like crazy across New Jersey,
but in New York. He wasn't getting any business because nobody's building there, especially on Long Island.
Not at this point. No.
So I personally, I believe in ghost spirits, all of that. I think the little things, maybe. Like the footsteps and stuff like that. But I don't think, as it'll go further in, all of that happened.
I mean... I think a lot of things that people have to understand is this house was built in the 40s. Actually,
1927.
So this is an old home.
As old as this is.
Exactly. So
our house that we live in was built in the 20s.
Yeah. So This is a bigger house than our house.
It's twice the size of our house.
Yeah. So foundation settled. Things weren't always built up to code. Things were added on. George is also doing his own maintenance, and I would gather he was probably not the best carpenter or handyman out there. Just a guess. I don't know. But he probably a lot of these sound like an old house that was probably built to different standards and by different standards of different builders. So it's like you're hearing a lot of stuff like slamming doors, this and that. And they were just like, well, we accounted for everybody. It's like, did you account for everybody? You know, people are quiet. They move around. You don't know. Plenty of times that we've moved around the house. We don't always know where everybody's moving.
Yeah. Like, I'm not saying that it wasn't just the house settling. I'm saying that there's a tragic murder that happened that it leaves an imprint. Stuff like that leaves an imprint.
As we're going to get into right now, the stuff that they're saying happened, it's like, what the fuck?
Where I don't think it, all that stuff happened. Maybe there was maybe doors closing on by themselves, but that, with a ghost, that takes a lot of energy.
As we're about to find out, this is a far cry what this is. This is borderline comical.
So, Missy befriended a mysterious entity she called Jody, which she described as a large pig with glowing red eyes. Missy claimed Jody could change its size and form, appearing as a small toy-like creature in her room or a massive figure outside her window. So I had the internet create Jody the pig.
Jesus. Oh, that, no! That is, what the fuck, dude?
Kathy grew increasingly alarmed when Missy insisted that Jody was real and described conversations that they had shared. I imagine... Those that listen to us that are in the military, you'll think this is hilarious. But I imagine that Kathy and Missy are talking about this, and George over here is like,
what?
Shit, Jody, they found out. Fuck, I gotta call her.
That's what I was saying. I was like,
you gotta call Jody.
Even money's little girl just suppressed the fact that her mom and her dad was having an affair.
Yeah. Fuck, Jody.
And honestly, I don't know how old Missy was when they moved in. I never saw ages for the children.
I would assume young if she's got an imaginary friend.
Exactly. That's what this sounds like. It's just legitimately an imaginary friend.
And kids often have them.
I had them.
Granted, this is a very disturbing...
She was five.
Yeah. So, granted, this is a very disturbing imaginary friend.
Kids are creepy. They can be creepy.
But... Again,
I didn't imagine her friend that was a clown.
What the fuck is wrong with this?
No.
I don't think I ever had an imaginary friend.
I don't think I did.
Did you have real friends?
Wow. Cool, dude.
No, and there's reasons for that because I had shitty parents.
The boys reported waking up in the middle of the night, unable to move as their bed shook violently. Both describe hearing muffled whispers and laughter, which they said seemed to come from the walls. So, in just a few weeks, the Lutz family went from hopeful new homeowners to desperate victims of forces they couldn't understand. The oppressive atmosphere, inexplicable phenomena, and growing emotional strain fractured their unity and planted the seeds for what would become one of the most infamous stories of the paranormal. Whether these experiences were manifestations of fear, psychological stress, or genuine supernatural activity, one thing is clear. The shadows in the house had begun to consume them. So, we'll get into the escalation of the hauntings. And again, I think as they escalate, more stuff is made up. And it's just, in my opinion, it's all bullshit.
Yeah.
I believe maybe 10% of what they say.
I would be less than that for me. I don't believe anything they said. I think if they just got into a financial bind, they were trying to cook up ways of figuring out how to get out of it.
Oh, just wait. That they go into that or later. It's hilarious.
And then we, of course, they get into that, and then they introduce the Warrens.
Or the Warrens introduce themselves, most likely.
Yeah, and then the Warrens...
No, I think...
hear a payday.
Oh, yeah.
I think they reach out to the Warren. Kathy reaches out to the Warrens.
No, I believe it's the other way. I believe the Warrens heard about it, because they had gone to news outlets, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Warrens had heard about it, because the Warrens were traveling paranormals.
Yeah, which their nephew, I believe.
They traveled around and did it, and they came up to this, and yep, sure as shit, there's ghost here.
Yeah.
Let's write a book. Let's make movies.
I think there's a quote that was made from one of the Warren's most adamant critics. Ed Warren never met a house that wasn't haunted.
Okay. Dude.
Well, I mean, really, that really does sum up the Warrens. They always came into a haunting believing that it was, they just believed everything.
Yeah. So, after the Lutz family settled into 112 Ocean Avenue, the strange occurrences they initially dismissed as harmless began to escalate in frequency, intensity, and sheer terror. What started as subtle signs of unease transformed into a cascade of events that the family could neither explain nor control. The house itself seemed alive, reacting to their presence with malice and growing more oppressive with each passing day. This part of their story is where the haunting reached its most disturbing heights, challenging their sanity and forcing them to question whether they could stay another day in their dream home turned nightmare. So they began experiencing phenomena that defied rational explanation. The family frequently heard footsteps in the hallways and on the stairs, even when everyone was accounted for. Again, doors slammed shut without warning, often with such force that the sound reverberated through the house. They reported hearing faint whispers and conversations as though a group of people was gathered in a distant part of the house. George claimed that the voices were unintelligible, but carried a sinister tone that filled him with dread. Here's my biggest thing, that this is full of shit. Hmm. Okay. You have George, who is a massive skeptic, like the biggest skeptic. And now he's all in. All of a sudden he is all in. Like there's a fine line of, yeah, maybe this is true, but it wasn't just that. No, he went all in and started seeing more and more stuff. All right, so the second floor bedrooms and the basement were particularly affected, with temperatures dropping so low that frost formed on windows and surfaces. No matter how high the thermostat was set, these areas remained icy cold, leading the family to question if the house itself was rejecting them.
That seems a bit extreme.
That's cold.
Yeah.
Like, it can get cold in here if we don't have the heat on. I've gotten it in the dead of winter. It'll get like 40 degrees in here. The windows still don't frost.
You need like a consistent below
20 degrees.
Consistently,
yeah.
Hours, not instantly.
I find that very hard to believe. Again, our house is built about the same time. I think our house is actually older. I think ours was built in like 1921. Theirs was built in 27.
I think Pam kind of hit it on the head. I think they found like little tiny stuff, like you said. Footprints. I mean, footsteps. I can't explain. A door closing. And then they all just start... Then they go full Hollywood. Because this is full Hollywood stuff right here.
So, as a child, I actually lived in the country in an older house that honestly terrified the living fucking shit out of me. I heard the footsteps. And it wasn't just like, sometimes you can just like be like, oh, it's just the house settling. No, I heard the footsteps heel to toe.
And the always prevailing theory about spirits and the paranormal is that they have to manifest so much energy just to do like footsteps or closing mm-hmm. the door or something. What we're getting into now is just full-on Hollywood. Like, nobody, if they were able to prove this existence, this would turn the laws of physics and science on its head.
Yeah, exactly.
So our house was actually built in 1928.
Oh, really? Burned just before the stock market crashed.
Yeah, save this page because I just found how much our house is worth. So on several occasions, family members felt a sudden chilling breeze pass by, even when no doors or windows were open. Kathy described the sensation as though an invisible figure was exhaling directly onto her skin. In reality, it's just one of the kids just.
Yeah, and then where they had the freezing spots. Okay, the basement. That gets cold.
Well, it's a basement.
Exactly. That's
what happens.
The second floor.
Lack of insulation.
Yeah, the second floor. Depending on where you are in the house, you can feel a slight breeze.
Yeah, it's an old house.
Exactly. It's not.
And it's not up to code. So the house began producing physical phenomena that were both baffling and horrifying. Thick gelatinous slime began oozing from the walls, door frames, and even keyholes. I find that so fucking hard to believe. I feel like I'm watching an episode of Supernatural. Listen, we have had spirits in our house. We can all attest to it. We've all felt it. We have cleansed this house multiple times. It happens. It's an older house.
Oh.
We have never seen that.
No.
This isn't fucking Supernatural.
Again, this one of my is favorite episodes almost of defying the laws of physics.
Honestly.
You are literally, something of energy is manifesting matter and pushing it through the walls. Like,
this is straight out of a movie.
Yeah,
like, all we heard was, like, our voices when... each other's voices when we weren't in the same room, or we were in the same room, and none of us were talking. Or just feeling an overwhelming sense of unease.
That's generally all that spirits can really manifest.
Yeah. Or if they're trying to get your attention, they do like a quick little whistle or something.
It's usually low-key. What they're describing, this is almost like a low-key pitch to a movie studio.
Exactly.
Well, you gotta think, so there were the mid to late 70s were big in horror movies.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
That was
so you had Stepford Wives came out in 75.
That's a horror movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a psychological horror. Yeah. Trilogy of, now there is the new one with like Nicole Kidman. Still good.
Body Snatchers?
No, Stefford. They did the Stefford.
Oh, yeah.
She's on the cover. It was a good one. That was way more psychological than horror. It was also
comedy,
yeah.
Too.
Trilogy of Terror came out in 1975. Devil's Reign, William Shatner. Good movie. It was a satanic cult in possession. Deep Red came out. That was Italian. Then Exorcist came out in 73. The Legend of Hell House came out in 73.
That's a good one. That was...
The Haunting of Hill House.
Yeah.
Then Burnt Offerings came out 76.
And that's also just describing what's more or less the American film industry. We haven't even touched on the British film industry.
But the reason I brought those up is because, in my opinion, a lot of those, especially like Legend of Hell House and The Exorcist, really inspired a lot of this stuff. If you look at it, it's so similar.
I don't watch horror movies, period, so I don't know.
Legend of Hell House is a great movie.
It has Roddy McDowall in it.
Yeah, great movie.
It really is.
I don't know who that is.
I would know him from Planet of the Apes, but yeah, you would.
Yeah, the OG Planet of the Apes.
Never seen it.
So... Kathy described the substance as foul-smelling and sticky, and it seemed to appear in random locations throughout the house.
Any money, George was just such a shitty contractor that all the mud from the foundation just spilled in.
Yeah. In addition to the slime, the family discovered pools of water on the kitchen floor and other areas with no apparent source of a leak or spill.
Again, he's probably such a shitty plumber that the pipes leak.
Or one of their kids spilled water and didn't confess to it.
And he's like, the ghost did it.
Kids. these manifestations were particularly troubling as they seemed to defy the physical walls of the house's structure. Because, listen, we already know that George was a hard ass. Are they going to admit to spilling water? No. Mm-hmm. In a house that he's fixing up? In a very expensive, nice house?
Yeah, they're not going to say fucking shit.
Heavy furniture, including tables and armchairs, were found in different locations from where they had been left.
Okay, that...
George moved stuff.
Yeah.
Again, people are moving stuff. They're not telling them.
Well, if it's a heavy furniture... Yes, can I move the couch on my own? Yes. Is it a bitch to move on my own? Yes, but you're gonna fucking hear it.
George recalled a night when the kitchen table slid across the floor, seemingly of its own volition, while the family looked on in stunned silence.
Pictures or didn't happen.
Yeah, really. In one chilling incident, a knife flew off the kitchen counter and embedded itself into the wall, narrowly missing Kathy. George got sick of his wife and decided to take her out. And threw a knife and then used this as an excuse.
She just didn't notice it. He'd be like, ghosted it.
Yeah. George later claimed that this act felt like a direct warning from the unseen forces in the house.
Why spend any money? These people were just fucking with each other. They were all just fucking with each other. And then they were like, ghosted it.
Yeah. The family began experiencing events that directly targeted their physical and psychological well-being during the night. Kathy described waking up one night to find herself floating several feet about her bed, unable to move or call for help. I call shit. That's straight out of The Exorcist.
Yeah.
Like I said, there's...
And that's supposed to be above. I think I accidentally put UV instead of VE.
So that's straight out of The Exorcist. If you watch The Exorcist, she floats above the bed, and then that's before her head does the spinning thing.
Never seen it.
It's great.
It's a great movie.
I'm good. I'd never want to see
Even the new ones are pretty good. George awakened by her panicked breathing, witnessed her being suspended in midair before she suddenly dropped back onto the mattress.
Again, pictures that didn't happen.
It's The Exorcist. Yeah. Daniel and Christopher reported feeling an unseen force holding them down in their beds, making it impossible to move or scream. What is that?
Sleep paralysis.
A lot of people have that.
I had it.
It's not a ghost.
I had it as a kid. Yeah. It's fucking terrifying.
Yeah, it's not a ghost. It's actually a condition.
Yeah. And
that can be cured with medicine.
And honestly, like, if the parents are feeling stress because of the financial stuff and everything like that, the kids are going to feel that stress and be under stress. I know I have sleep paralysis. When does it come on? When I'm extremely stressed.
This one's just hilarious.
Both boys claim to hear malevolent laughter during these episodes as though something was mocking their helplessness.
I bet you anyway, one of their siblings was just laughing at
Yeah.
Them.
That, or I've heard stuff when I'm in sleep paralysis. It's just your mind fucking with you.
On multiple occasions, the family described being awakened by a cacophony of sounds. George reported hearing the sound of a marching band stopping through the living room, complete with metallic clang of instruments, though no one was there.
I bet you anybody, someone was playing the TV too loud.
Yeah. This is the greatest show!
The ghosts are watching musicals.
That did not exist then.
Yeah.
Other nights were filled with blood-curdling screams that echoed through the house, leaving the family terrified to go back to sleep. Missy, the youngest child, formed a connection with the entity she called Jody. Missy described Jody as a pig-like creature with glowing red eyes that could change its size and appearance. She claimed Jody would comfort her at night, telling her that they would always be friends. So, just picture that thing.
Yeah, no.
We'll always be friends. George and Kathy both claimed to have seen Jody themselves. George described looking out the window one night and seeing a pair of glowing red eyes staring back at him. On another occasion, Missy said Jody told her not to worry because nobody can hurt her here.
No.
Nobody can hurt you here.
Why does that sound like
Are we going to have a new D&D
character? Because he has tusks.
We going to have a new D&D character, Jody the pig?
No.
We got to replace the sheep, the goat.
No, we are bringing Mutton. We have to bring Mutton Chop back.
He's dead.
Some way. We have to have Mutton Chop. And it has to be targeted to certain Kara's character.
The discovery of the red room in the basement added another layer of fear to the family's experience. The small windowless space had no identifiable function and was not listed in the house's original blueprints. Paranormal investigators later theorized that the room served as a spiritual hotspot, amplifying the negative energy in the house. I will tell you, if we're calling this the Red Room, we know what Red Rooms are used for.
Yep.
I think that's what the DeFeos used it for. The DeFeos, Mommy and Daddy had a Red Room. George found himself inexplicably compelled to visit the Red Room, even though he described feeling physically sick whenever he stepped inside. He later admitted that the room filled him with dark, intrusive thoughts that he could not shake. PTSD. He's a Marine in Vietnam. Well, shell shock.
Yeah.
We didn't classify it as PTSD then. No. It wasn't until the 80s that we classified it as PTSD. Shell shock. But same thing. At Kathy's insistence, the family invited a local Catholic priest to bless the house. Upon entering one of the upstairs bedrooms, the priest reported hearing a deep, guttural voice commanding him to get out.
And keep in mind, also, this is only coming from Kathy. We have
not the priest.
Yes, the priest. As far as I can tell, I've heard, and I think...
Yeah, there was no evidence from the Catholic Church that they ever got a blessing, that they ever got an exorcism, anything. The church has no record whatsoever of the Lutz family requesting help.
There wouldn't be a record of a blessing. A blessing is nothing formal. You don't have to fill out a form. The priest doesn't have to fill out a form. It's literally, hey, Father, can you come by in a spare moment and bless our house? Okay, that's how a blessing usually happens. An exorcist, they're classified by the Vatican. I mean, it took years for a reporter from Time magazine to track down Ronald Doe. He is the boy that was partly the inspiration for The Exorcist. Because the Catholic Church scrubbed the records and they classified them. He had to do like some really creative detective work to find him. So there wouldn't be any record of an exorcist. They don't.
So, and here's the thing. So the priest that was there is Father Pecoraro. That was his name. In the movie, they changed his name to Father Mancuso. But
they kept him Italian.
Yeah. So Father Pecoraro confirmed in an interview, he confirmed that he visited the house and felt something unusual, but he denied hearing a voice. But later in a 1981 court case where he was under oath, via an affidavit, he said he only spoke with the Lutzes over the phone and never actually entered the house. So, which contradicted the books and everything.
Wow.
So and that's under oath. So that's the one I believe.
Yeah.
Cause listen, I'm sure the Catholic Church goes, you lied before, you lie under oath, you're done. That's a big deal. Could you imagine if it came out that a Catholic priest lied under oath, Catholic Church would.
Oh, yeah,
be like, nope, we cut ties, they disavow him, they defrock him.
Yeah, they defrock him and he would be out.
Yeah, so probably. That's the one I believe, yeah, that he talked over the phone and was just like, oh, what do you want me to do?
Well, and that's the sad thing of what most people
do. Because I think, don't you have to provide, like, evidence to them to get them to come out there? Because otherwise, they'd be going to hundreds upon hundreds of these.
So, with an exorcist, you're right.
You're the resident Catholic, so.
So, you're right. First off, your parish priest does not know how to exorcise demons, all right?
It's a specialty.
It is. It really is. Yeah. They're said to only be like a couple hundred trained exorcists in the world.
It's like any job. You go into the job and then you convert into a speciality.
Pretty much. It's just kind of, and there's no real like formal way of doing it. You're just kind of
have your own thing.
You kind of get selected, you get chosen, you encounter it. Because here's the thing. Most parish priests are just, they're your priests. They hear the confessions of the community. They serve a spiritual
read
need.
The Bible.
Yeah, they service mass. A lot of priests treat it as like it's just a job.
Yeah.
You know, that's just how it is. It's for better or for worse. You know, so most priests will never encounter anything really evil in the sense of like Asmodeus has risen from the depths of hell to possess this little boy. They'll probably never encounter that. But, and the ones who do, usually they hopefully they have the fortitude to be like, okay, I am out of my league here. I gotta go talk to the Monsignor or the Arch Cardinal or whatever and just figure this out. They have a chain of command. Now the parish priest, he's the one who's like, I don't know what to do. I'm out of my league. Help me out here. And then it'll get filtered to the Vatican.
Yeah.
Vatican has their own vetting process. They go through psychological examination, medical examination.
Keep in mind that they have their own police force. They have like their own security force, all of that. So
they have a lot of, they have a very big investigative apparatus. You will probably
speaking of thoughts with the Pope.
Yes.
He's not doing
well. Not doing well.
Yeah.
Kidney failure.
But you will probably see more psychologists and medical doctors before you ever see a priest.
They say yes.
We've ruled everything out.
Now let's get the priest in.
And then the priest shows up. And even then, sometimes the priest will just, if anyone's ever watched the movie The Pope's Exorcist, Russell Crowe's character is based off a real priest who lived, a little flamboyant, but he did live. He said, most of the time, all I do is a little theater, a little talking, and I cure them. He used the word cure. He's like,
all mental.
It is. But he obviously did encounter many actual demons. But there's a huge road process that goes there. And again, Vatican does not disclose what that criteria is.
That's all classified.
It used to be completely classified, but Lease came out. That's how we know, like, oh, they're speaking in different tongues. They're this and that. So then once those leaked out, the mental illnesses started adjusting. Then they started legitimately non-possessed people were now speaking in tongues or in everything and other such things. So,
and with all that, I highly suggest everybody watches the show Evil.
Yes.
It is so good. It is really good. And it's actually not, so it's not a horror show.
On a scary level of punk ass bitch like me, and I can tolerate, and there's someone can tolerate.
Moments that are scary.
Mostly, it's kind of funny.
It's really actually funny. So,
they introduced a nun in there.
So, you have a psychologist, you have a priest in training, and then you have a technology contractor that they all work together to solve these cases, basically. And the priest in training is the same guy that plays Luke Cage. Marvel's Luke Cage, big black guy, big muscular black guy, great actor. And then there are like some of the scary parts. One is the all black demon.
Oh, yeah.
That's the scariest part, but he's kind of funny.
He looks
creepy, but he's actually kind of funny. Like he cracks jokes and like, and fucks with people because he's a paralysis demon. He is.
Okay, maybe I shouldn't watch it because I've already seen my own.
He's great. It's great. It is a very good show. It's supposed to be renewed. It's available on Paramount Plus, but I suggest watching that because they actually talk about the process in it.
Yeah.
They don't go full in depth, obviously.
Because again, like you said, they don't, no one other than the Vatican exorcist specialist and the Pope and probably some, a handful of cardinals. No one really, they keep that a very closely guarded secret.
Well, which is a good thing. Okay. Yeah, I know who that is.
And then you know him.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is a good thing.
It is a good thing because then people would be like,
they'd probably be there and worse.
They would fake it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's happened too. There have been people who have tried to fake a possession and they just go off of what they know from movies or from what leaks on the internet and stuff, but the Vatican usually is pretty good about weeding it through and like, no, you're really not.
Like, this image, you're telling me that this is creepy? I think this is hilarious. You're just sitting here interviewing a demon.
That's a little creepy.
That one?
Oh, yeah.
He's just sitting there interviewing a demon. This is the one I was talking about.
Yeah.
But he's funny.
don't like it.
And then this is the one that was sitting there.
It's like, fuck it. That looks like fucking Krampus a little bit.
Kind of, yeah. It has, like, all of those are eyes. Very, like, Baphomet-ish.
So, do I believe in demons? Yes. Do I believe that they would come up and possess, like, the big ones? No.
Oh, there's the one with the nun.
Yeah, the nun is funny in this one.
She's hilarious.
She's, like, no nonsense.
She's just like, I'm showing a picture of the demon where it's, like, teeth kind of pop out, and she's just like, eh. She's like, no nonsense. She's not terrified at all. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
She's funny.
Like, do I believe in possessions? Yes. Do I think that they happen as often as people say?
No. Well, here's the thing, though. If demon possession was as prevalent as people make it out to be or whatever, we'd have no doubts about God or any religion. Because everything is yin and yang. So if there's all these demons possessing people and doing all kinds of fucked up shit, like they can prove it, it's like, well, okay, that kind of dispels a lot of the doubts.
So rather than calming the house, the blessing seemed to intensify the phenomena because it didn't happen. Doors slammed more frequently, the mysterious cold spots grew colder, and the family began hearing louder, more aggressive sounds at night.
And if I remember right, this was like November, December timeframe, right?
Yeah. So
New York is motherfucking cold as shit.
Especially right there. They're right on the water,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. So, of course, you're going to get cold spots that grow colder if it's in the middle of fucking winter.
I don't believe they had central heat. They just had the fireplace. They had the fireplace.
Yeah.
That's it.
And the fire...
Fireplaces work, but on a house that big, it's not going to.
And it makes certain areas even fucking colder.
So, George became increasingly distant, spending long hours in the basement or by the fireplace. His obsession with the house's energy alienated him from Kathy and the children. He also began snapping at Kathy over minor issues, a sharp contrast to the warm, supportive partner he had been before the move.
Oh, because his business is failing and his house is falling apart.
Yeah. Kathy tried to hold the family together, but the stress of the haunting left her emotionally exhausted. She began questioning her own sanity, wondering if the events were a product of their collective imagination. They were.
It was.
Daniel and Christopher avoided being alone in any room of the house, often clinging to their mother or huddling together in fear at night. Missy's bond with Jody further unnerved her parents as she seemed increasingly detached from reality.
Because you're ignoring your daughter.
Yeah. The escalation of the hauntings at 112 Ocean Avenue broke the Lutz family down piece by piece. Their once close bonds were strained by the overwhelming fear and confusion caused by the relentless activity in the house. As the phenomena intensified, the family faced the growing realization that they might not survive their stay if they didn't leave. Whether caused by malevolent spirits, psychological stress, or something in between, the events inside the house remain one of the most disturbing chapters in paranormal history. So, the Lutz family's harrowing experiences at 112 Ocean Avenue did not end with their departure. In fact, their claims of a haunting set off a wave of investigations that attracted a mix of paranormal researchers, skeptics, and opportunists. These investigations aimed to uncover whether the events in the Amityville house were genuine manifestations of the supernatural or merely an elaborate hoax. We're going to talk about the perspectives that emerged as investigators, experts, and even filmmakers descended on the now infamous house. Ed and Lorraine Warren.
I think that they may, out of all their investigations, maybe 5% of them were true.
These motherfuckers.
If that. I'm being generous with the 5%.
Oh, I definitely think they ran into a couple of haunted houses. Some of the stuff they described.
But when you run into 5,000 houses,
oh, yeah,
a few of them are down to be haunted.
Oh, yeah.
That's why I'm saying. I'm being generous with the 5%.
You throw them out at the wall and see what sticks.
Pretty much.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Renowned for their work on high-profile hauntings, including the Perrin family case, which is The Conjuring. Great movie. Were among the first to conduct a thorough investigation of the Amityville house.
Even though The Conjuring was all bullshit.
Yeah. Ed was a self-taught demonologist, of course, while Lorraine was a clairvoyant and medium, and together they founded the New England Society for Psychic Research.
Because they lost my membership application.
Or NESPR.
Oh, yeah.
NESPR. I don't know if they called it NESPR, but... the Warrens visited the house in 1976, shortly after the Lutz family fled. They claimed the house harbored a malevolent presence that had not only tormented the Lutzes, but also influenced Ronald DeFeo Jr. to commit the murders.
Never mind all that years of emotional, physical abuse and drug and alcohol use.
I'm pretty sure this is right around the time that he started saying that Robert DeFeo started saying, I heard voices.
Of course. Of course, he wanted to get out of prison.
Because I think that was one of his... I don't think it came out in his actual trial. I think it was more the... whatchamacallits.
The appeal process.
Yes.
Yeah, he was making... He's just, again, like the lessons. I mean, like the Warrens. He's just throwing things at the wall and just hope to see whatever... Say, maybe this will get me out of prison.
Well, as we'll find out later, there's his lawyer was involved in all of this.
Of course.
So him saying, I heard voices, was more because of what the Lutzes said.
Oh, yeah.
It was to get himself out of jail.
I mean, the Warrens, this is one of the problems I always had about the Warrens. Warrens just, they just made it up. They never, even the some of the modern paranormal investigators who go about today, I'm not going to name names because I really don't want a libel case. They're a lot smarter with it, but they still, it's still bullshit. Like, with it, again,
Zach Bagans.
Yeah, it popped in my head.
I know exactly.
I don't give a fuck. Zach Bagans is a fucking fraud.
Yeah.
He can come after me all he wants. Zach Bagans is a fucking fraud. It's proven.
Brief thing on the Conjuring. Brief thing. They talked about Bathsheba Sherman as the witch who haunted the Conjuring, the Perron family house, and everything. First of all, luckily somebody in the Rhode Island, the Rhode Island Historical Society finally got tired of hearing about, you know, the grave of Bathsheba Sherman getting vandalized by people. He finally just did a deep dive, and it turned out there was nothing wrong with her. She never killed anybody. She didn't hang herself from a tree on her property.
And wasn't one of the things she killed her child?
Yeah. Bathsheba Sherman was a woman. She was born in the late 1800s. She lived, she died, she married. The only unusual thing about Bathsheba Sherman was that she married at age 31. That was the weirdest thing about her in the time when people were usually got married at like 17, 18. She got married in her 30s. By our standards, nothing unusual. She had one son. He lived to the 50s. He died, and that's it. And this is not like the Old West or anything where there's no records. This is Rhode Island, the town. Like, some of the stuff was just bullshit. And the Warrens were like, yep, this absolutely happened. She is a descendant of some witch who died in the Salem witch trials, and she was a witch who gave her soul to Satan and tried to sacrifice her child.
It's which, like, we will get into more when we cover The Conjuring.
Yeah, and it's...
So, during their investigation, Lorraine reportedly felt an overwhelming sense of dread and claimed to see a dark demonic figure.
Of course she did.
The Warrens' investigations produced one of the most famous pieces of evidence associated with the Amityville case. A photograph taken inside the house showing a young boy with glowing eyes peering out of a doorway.
Any money was still neighborhood. If you go,
That, honestly, I think they did catch something because it is. You do see ghosts on photos. I've seen it.
This is really clear. Most of the stuff is usually shadow work.
Yeah, shadow? But that is more shadow. Like, it was enhanced in the one, but that is shadowy. That is in the shadows.
I'm still not convinced that it's not some neighborhood kid who broke into the house.
I agree. I don't believe that picture's real.
No.
So...
Now, I believe also the Warrens started getting into more claims about the property itself.
So, Yeah, the boy was not identified as any living person present during the investigation. The photograph has since been cited as potential proof of paranormal activity. I don't believe it. The warrants declared the house to be infested with demonic forces, asserting that the energy stemmed from a supposed Native American burial ground. Ranks a curse in the area. That's standard. The Native Americans that lived in Long Island, New York.
So I looked it up because I remembered hearing about this. There's no Native American burial grounds where the Amityville house is.
Why is it that the Native American burial grounds are always evil? Have you noticed that?
Because they don't. Nobody understands the Native American culture.
As a Native American, it's very offensive that they blame us for everything.
Well, we know there's you accidentally disturb a Native burial ground, and there's just some ghosts of some Native Americans who are just chilling, kind of like in that one show. It's like, yeah, we're here now.
So, there were Native Americans living in Long Island. The Shinnecock Nation lived there. But they were east in the Southampton area. Mm. So if there were ever any remains found in Amityville, it would have been from Massapequa or the Secotogue tribes. But there's been no evidence ever that there was any burial sites there. And even the Amityville Historical Society has publicly stated there is no record of a burial ground at 112 Ocean Avenue. And believe me, even before the 70s, they were really big on going through and trying to find every single burial site. All the way through up until today.
Well, nobody wants to disturb the dead.
So they, again, it's a crock of shit.
Mm-hmm.
Stop blaming the Native Americans for this. Or just stop building on their land. But give the land back to the Native Americans. That's my thought. Their findings drew significant attention to the case, but also sparked criticism, with skeptics accusing the Warrens of sensationalizing the haunting to bolster their public profile.
100%.
They would never do that.
Yeah,
they've never done that before.
Actually, you know, you're going to tell me that they didn't battle a demon in England.
They did.
Oh,
hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah.
Good thing Ed is proficient in demonic hand-to-hand combat.
Oh, I thought you were going to do this on my...
I don't like Hans Holzer either. But Hans Holzer is a parapsychologist and prolific author on supernatural topics. He conducted his own investigation with the help of psychic medium Ethel Johnson Myers.
I actually never heard of Hans Holzer before.
Yeah.
He
has a few books out.
I think they have a TV show on Travel Channel, like the Holzer Files. I think that's the one.
You're about to see why I don't like either of these two. Johnson Myers claimed to channel the spirit of a Native American chief who was enraged by the house's construction on sacred land. Holzer concluded that the house was cursed due to its location. Again, like I stated, no Native Americans lived in Amityville ever. Ever. Multiple psychics conducted seances in the house, many of whom reported encountering spirits tied to the DeFeo murders. Some claim the spirits of the DeFeo family members remain trapped in the house, while others suggested that darker non-human entities were responsible for the activity. Paranormal investigators used early versions of EMF detectors and thermal imaging to search for anomalies in the house. While some investigators claimed to find evidence of unusual energy spikes, others reported no significant findings. Neighbors and prior visitors were interviewed, with some confirming strange feelings when visiting the house, while others denied any unusual occurrences. Now that, the neighbors and the visitors, you can feel when a house is tense. Okay. When,
and that's usually from the people who are occupying
it. Yes. So that's what I feel that they felt.
And honestly, the strange feelings. Of course they're going to probably have strange feelings because a whole fucking family was murdered in this house.
Mm-hmm. everybody knows it, so everyone's going in with the...
Exactly. Like, so they are expecting it to be haunted. They are expecting to feel this shit.
So now we'll go on to some of the debunks.
Yeah, when I read this real quickly, for some reason my mind saw it as Stephen King. And I was like, why did Stephen King investigate this place?
Probably could have made a better story.
Probably.
I just read it really fast. Like, Stephen King? Oh, no, Stephen King.
So... Yeah, so Stephen Kaplan, founder of the Parapsychology Institute of America, approached the case with a critical eye. He initially supported the Lutz family, but later accused them of fabricating the haunting. Kaplan noted a consistency in the Lutz's timeline in question, while no subsequent homeowners reported similar phenomena. Okay, so here's this. After the Lutzes left, okay, they left in 76, January of 76, okay, the Cromartie family bought the house in March 1977, just after over a year. Completely denied experiencing any hauntings, calling the entire story a hoax. They're the ones that renovated and changed it to 108 Ocean Avenue to deter trespassers. In 1987, Peter and Jean O'Neill owned the house. In 1987, they owned it until 1997.
They're there a good long while.
Nothing
happened.
It was just a tourist attraction. Wilson family owned it from 97 to 2010. Brian Wilson, not the Beach Boys. It literally says not the Beach Boys. Because Brian Wilson obviously is one of the most famous part of the Beach Boys.
I don't know their names, so.
Yes, Brian Wilson, amazing singer. We all love the Beach Boys. Beach Boys are great.
Oh, yeah.
So... He firmly stated nothing ever happened during his time there. That's 3 years. Well, 13 years. Yeah, 13 years. The later owners, we don't have the names, but 2010 on, none of them have reported it. We don't have any of the names now because the current owners decided to remain private. They kept everything private for obvious reasons.
Also, keep in mind that there were two other owners before the DeFeo family.
Correct.
And they never said anything. So that debunks the whole curse on Native America. I mean, that was already a crock of shit anyway. But two other people owned that home before the DeFeos. And I think one of them went on to be something of a Hollywood star. Nobody ever said anything. They were even interviewed. They were like, nope, nothing happened.
And please remember, this is a private home. Do not...
Don't go visit it.
At their house. Like, don't take pictures. Nothing.
So, I mean, technically they can't take pictures because they're on public.
Yeah, but it's still weird.
William Weber, that was the DeFeo lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
He claimed he and the Lutzes made up parts of the stories over drinks.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no. I think we get into that more. Yeah. Yeah, we do.
But yeah, so... Let's see. Skeptics pointed out that no physical evidence of the supernatural was ever documented in the house. The slime, odors, and other manifestations described by the Lutzes were never verified by later investigators. So you're telling me that nasty, thick sludge never left any traces?
Yeah.
You guys just cleaned it up.
Yeah.
Keep some for evidence, maybe?
Exactly.
So...
Take some pictures? I'd be taking pictures.
I'm pretty sure slime existed back then.
Yeah, I mean, if...
Just go to the store, buy some slime.
Yeah, if our walls started doing that shit, I would be taking pictures being like, what the fuck?
Well...
Shortly after, also, start running.
But also, keep in mind, this is the 70s. Not everybody had a camera.
That is true, but...
Just, the Warrens had it because of what they did.
Yeah.
Keep in mind, nowadays we have a camera in our pockets. Yeah. But this is 1975. Not everybody has a camera. Cameras... If you got a good camera, they were expensive. So some experts suggested that the Lutz family may have experienced a form of mass hysteria, amplifying each other's fears and misinterpreting mundane events as paranormal.
Which usually happens in hauntings.
Yes. The financial strain of the house, coupled with George's reported interest in the occult, may have contributed to the family's psychological state. Oh. What, a Marine interested in the occult? Aren't they a cult?
There are, yeah, there are. And I believe that one comes from one of Kathy's sons who later years, he basically kind of like, yeah, George
recanted.
Well, he was kind of bad with he had his own inconsistencies, because at first when he got older, like became an adult, he started like backing up with George, let's say. Then all of a sudden, a few years, when that didn't pan out, a few years later, he started saying, no, George was just a piece of shit. And if there was any paranormal stuff, George brought it in because he started doing like occult and satanic shit. Even his story started becoming inconsistent.
So critics argued that investigators who were already believers in the supernatural may have been more likely to interpret ambiguous findings as evidence of a haunting.
And I believe he went back to saying that George was right, like his parents are right, and that everything was true.
Yeah.
Well, then, the Lutz family collaborated with author Jay Anson to produce The Amityville Horror, A True Story, published in 1977. The book was a massive success, but was criticized for its dramatic embellishments. Subsequent film adaptation further cemented the house's reputation as a site of horror, though it deviated significantly from the original accounts.
The original Amityville Horror movie was for what it was. It's a great horror film. You get it's got the slow, creepy horror to it. It's really good. But again, it's based off of bullshit.
Yeah. George and Kathy Lutz gave numerous interviews standing by their story despite mounting skepticism. Some accused them of profiting from the tragedy, pointing to their financial difficulties as a motive for the alleged hoax. William Weber, Ronald DeFeo Jr.'s defense attorney, claimed that he collaborated with the Lutzes to fabricate the story, adding details to make it more marketable. Weber alleged that George and Kathy brainstormed the haunting narrative over several bottles of wine and claimed that the Lutzes denied.
Of course they're going to deny it.
Yeah.
Subsequent homeowners filed lawsuits against various parties involved in the media frenzy, citing privacy violations and harassment from curious fans and trespassers. All well within their rights. I would do the same thing. For believers in the supernatural, the Amityville case remains one of the most compelling examples of a real haunting. The Warrens and other investigators continue to cite it as a hallmark case for their careers. For skeptics, the case is a cautionary tale of mass hysteria, media sensationalism, and the dangers of conflating fiction with reality. The house has changed ownership several times, like we said, with no subsequent residents reporting paranormal activity. However, the enduring fascination with Amityville Horror has kept investigators returning, each with their own conclusions about what, if anything, truly happened within those walls. The investigations beyond the Lutz family reveal a complex interplay of belief, skepticism, and exploitation. While some argue that the haunting was a genuine paranormal event, others see it as a manufactured story designed to profit from tragedy. Regardless of where the truth lies, the investigations have only added to the mystique of 112 Ocean Avenue, ensuring that its story continues to captivate and divide audiences to this day. Now, let's talk about the scrutinies of it, the inconsistencies. One of the main points of contention among skeptics is the apparent evolution of the Lutz's family account over time. Early interviews with George and Kathy provided vague descriptions of the haunting, but later retellings, particularly in collaboration with author Jay Anson, included more dramatic details such as levitation, red-eyed pigs, and green slime. Critics argue that these embellishments were added to heighten the sensationalism of the story for commercial gain. The Lutzes claim the events occurred over a 28-day period, yet skeptics pointed out that some reported phenomena appeared to overlap or contradict the family's initial accounts. The involvement of the Catholic priest, for example, has been disputed, with the Diocese of Rockville Center stating that no official record of a priest being attacked during a blessing exists. So, I think we should agree with the diocese.
Yeah. What has happened is there have been, in the past, I'm talking about not like this, but there have been priests who've gone to bless a house, and they have reported things happening. Because again, a blessing is, if there's a genuine demonic presence, a blessing will, it's like it's like poking something. It's like, yeah, get the hell. It won't get rid of a bad spirit or anything. It just pisses it off. So that's how, that's also kind of can be sometimes a telltale sign that something bad is there, because what should be just a regular blessing will just provoke a big reaction.
So some of the motives that people believe is, obviously, they moved into a house they can't afford. His business was failing. The family was burdened by the cost of the home. So they create the haunting story to give an opportunity to escape the mortgage. Mm-hmm. So if there is a haunting in there, that bank is more than likely going to let them skip out on that mortgage and leave and not have to pay anything because it's dangerous to live there.
Yeah, because they live there less than a month.
Yeah.
But I guarantee you, no bank is going to probably say, like, the ghosts are there, are making it possible to leave. They're probably going to be like, uh-huh.
So, I believe they were able to get out of their mortgage. They purchased the house in December for $80,000. After 28 days, they abandoned the house, claiming they were forced out by paranormal activity. They left behind everything. They began negotiating with the bank and other parties to relieve themselves of the mortgage. So they worked with their attorney.
William Weber.
Became their attorney.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he doesn't really have much of a job now that his last client got sent to jail.
Reports suggest they defaulted on their mortgage, but rather than a foreclosure, they managed to transfer the property back to the bank. The bank then repossessed the house and put it back on the market in 77, allowing the Cromartie family to purchase it. So, yes, they did get out of it. But, I mean, the bank wasn't out any money because they just... what happens is the bank buys it from them for like a dollar. And then, which is... Basically, the bank pays the transfer fees.
Yeah.
And that is how they're able to get out of it. So, they don't get any money back that they put into it, but the bank pays the transfer fees. Is super cheap, and then they transfer the deed, and then the bank just gets to resell it at a higher price. And I'm sure that the Cromartie family bought it for more than $80,000. So also one of the skepticism is the collaboration with William Weber. They fabricate the story to help sell Ronald DeFeo Jr.'s story that these hauntings made him do this.
Sure, the lawyer wants to, fuck, I gotta get some money out of this guy.
Yeah. So despite the dramatic claims of slime ooze covering the walls, objects levitating, windows shattering, no physical evidence were ever issued. So you have windows that shatter. There should be records of that. Because is he really going to replace those windows on his own? Number one. Number two, show us records that you bought new windows.
Yeah.
So, like, there's a record. You still get a receipt. It's 1970, but receipts exist.
Yeah.
So, you're just... Maybe that's why it's so cold, because you have no windows.
Your children broke the window. You're like, oh, well, save money. I'm going to install a window and never installed installation.
Photographs and recordings taken by investigators, including the Warrens, failed to provide conclusive proof of paranormal activity. Later, homeowners reported no structural damage consistent with the Lutz's claims, such as doors ripped off hinges or walls being stained with strange substances. And I promise you, he's not that good of a contractor.
Mm-hmm.
Experts in psychology and parapsychology have suggested that the Lutz's may have been experiencing a combination of stress and sleep deprivation and suggestibility.
Yeah, thank.
I mean, that, the, I feel like that's the big thing. Is,
yeah. It's probably all in their heads, and they just decided, like, you know what? Let's make some money off of this.
So do we know the difference between psychology and parapsychology?
I actually do not.
Okay. So
parapsychology is more ghost stuff than.
Yeah. So psychology is the scientific study of the human mind, behavior, emotions, and mental processes. Then parapsychology is the study of alleged psychic or supernatural abilities, ghosts, telepathy, ESP. So, psychology being a real degree and parapsychology not. Financial strain combined with the knowledge of the DeFeo murders may have heightened their sensitivity to normal household creaks and groans, leading them to interpret ordinary occurrences as paranormal. You know what it reminds me of? Do you remember Monster House? It was the...
Oh, I never saw that movie.
It was like the kid. It was a kid's movie. It was a...
I think I've seen
that. The house opened up and ate people.
I think I remember it.
I loved it as a kid. That's what it reminds me of. Like, they hear these creaks and groans, and all of a sudden this house is trying to swallow them.
Yeah. I mean, I think they probably, if you see the old front facade of the house, it had that evil look, like the little, like, almost weird-shaped windows. It's like, it looked evil, like the house.
Like Monster House.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have seen that.
Great movie. Well, it was a kid's movie from like 2006 or something like that. Mm-hmm. Right, maybe. So some psychologists argue that the family's collective fear could have fed into a feedback loop where one person's perception of an unusual event reinforced the other's belief in the haunting. This phenomenon known as contagious fear is well documented in cases of alleged hauntings. So Stephen Kaplan, again, the founder of the Parapsychology Institute of America, was one of the most vocal critics of the Amityville horror story. Initially contacted by the Lutzes to investigate the house, Kaplan later accused them of perpetrating a hoax after discovering inconsistencies in their stories. He pointed out that the Lutzes had not experienced any paranormal activity before moving into the house, suggesting that their story was reactive rather than spontaneous. He also noted that subsequent owners of the house reported no unusual activity, undermining the claim that the house itself was haunted. Kaplan and other skeptics argued that Jay Anson's book exaggerated and fabricated key elements of the haunting to maximize its appeal to readers. For instance, the description of gelatinous slime dripping from the walls and a demon pig named Jody were not part of the Lutz's initial claims.
Mm-hmm.
The film adaptation in 1979 further distorted the narrative, introducing entirely fictional scenes such as the house spewing blood and Father Mancuso being blinded by supernatural forces. Skeptics contend that these dramatizations solidified the haunting in popular culture, but deviated significantly from any supposed reality. Some skeptics propose that if any paranormal phenomena occurred, they may have been residual energy from the violent DeFeo murders rather than an act of haunting. Residual hauntings are said to be non-interactive imprints of past events, akin to a replayed recording, which could explain some of the Lutzes' experiences without invoking malicious spirits. The knowledge of the DeFeo murders may have influenced the Lutzes' perception of the house, causing them to attribute normal occurrences to supernatural forces. This theory is supported by George Lutz's fascination with the murders and his repeated attempts to research the crime. Now, I wonder if... So, obviously, there is a legal obligation to report if a murder or crime has been committed in the house.
I think that's only for certain states, though. I think it's every state.
Every state now. I think they changed it to every state. But imagine if that realtor never would have disclosed that.
What would have happened? None of it would have happened.
Probably not. I don't think so.
Because I think that they probably, we don't have a lot of money. Let us move into this house. It's way above our budget.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was true.
And we can make a quick buck out of it. Because essentially, that's what they did. They got out of a mortgage that they couldn't afford. And they knew that they couldn't afford it. But now they have a movie, they have a book, they have multiple other things that they're getting royalties from.
I apologize. I was wrong. So California, Alaska, and South Dakota. California must disclose any death that occurred on the property within the last 3 years. Alaska must disclose any death on the property within the last year. South Dakota must disclose homicides or suicides on the property, period. But New York, New Jersey, Texas, Florida, Ohio, Illinois, Colorado, and Pennsylvania do not have to disclose them.
Yeah, I believe there's no federal law. I think a lot of states are adopting the same laws, but yeah.
And then New York said that if a home is publicly known to be haunted, the seller must disclose it.
There
we go. As a court case in 1991. But as a buyer, you do have a right to ask. So I would ask, especially in older homes.
For no other reason, just to make sure you don't buy a house and then some people, idiot ghost hunters, show up to your door one day trying to ask you to check out your house.
Yeah, I actually have not done it yet, but I plan to do a deep, deep dive into this house. Because, again, this house is old, so who knows what happened. This house has been through many wars.
Well, the land
has. And the land, too.
I mean, yeah, I mean, this house was built in 1928. That's a lot of wars.
World War II, Vietnam, Korea.
Yeah.
Cold War.
Gulf. So some investigators have suggested that environmental factors such as EMF or infrasound could have contributed to the Lutz's experiences. High EMF levels can cause feelings of paranoia, unease, and even hallucinations, while infrasound has been linked to sensations of dread and disorientation. Skeptics have noted that older houses like 112 Ocean Avenue often have structural quirks that can create eerie effects, such as a drafty windows producing whispers or creaky floors mimicking footsteps. Despite the criticism, the Lutzes remain steadfast in their claims, asserting that they fled the house for their own safety. In interviews, George and Kathy consistently stated that they had no reason to fabricate their story, as it brought them more hardship than financial gain. In an effort to prove their credibility, George and Kathy voluntarily underwent polygraph tests, which they passed.
Which, by the way, in the 70s, polygraphing was still fairly new, and it was a lot easier back then to fake it than it is today.
Yeah. While skeptics argue that polygraphs are not foolproof, the test added a layer of complexity to the case.
Also, they probably just convinced themselves that they were hearing something.
Exactly.
Which again, going back to what Pam probably would say, it probably did occur. There probably some weird shit probably did happen. And yeah, I mean, they all knew that the house was the site of a horrific murder. So the energy and the vibe is off. So they probably just convinced themselves it was haunted, but then they just embellished it because they apparently can make the money off of
this. So, going into the media side, the book, published in 77, became an instant bestseller. So, it sold millions of copies worldwide and was translated into multiple languages, so it reached international audience. Critics often dismissed the book as sensationalized or outright fiction, but that didn't deter its popularity. Anson's ability to weave suspense with the Lutz's claims created an enduring template for supernatural storytelling. Then we have the movie, released in 1979, solidified its place in popular culture. This starred, of course, James Brolin, Margot Kidder, as George and Kathy Lutz. It was a box office hit. It earned over $86 million, which, keep in mind, in 2025, that would be $373 million.
Oh, yeah, this is a hit.
If I remember right, I think it was with the book. I didn't see it. It's a repeat, I'm sorry. With the book, when Jay Anson was writing it, I can't remember. It was either Ed Warren or the lawyer, Weber, said to dramatize it. Make it more.
Yeah.
Because Jay Anson said, it's boring with what what they said happened.
Yeah, it's just...
So a lot of it is extremely embellished.
Yeah. Also, fun little fact, James Brolin is Josh Brolin's father.
Yes. Everybody should know that.
Yes.
If you are a human being that has seen movies, you should know that. But again, this was an independent film.
Really?
Yes.
I always thought it was a studio movie.
No, it was an independent film, and it was the highest grossing independent film of its time.
Huh.
The equivalent of almost $400 million. That is insane for a movie.
And then it would subsequently generate horrific, badly made, straight-to-video movies.
Of course, created a franchise, numerous sequels, prequels, and reboots. In 2005, they did do the remake with Ryan Reynolds and Melissa George.
It was bad.
Yeah, oh, not Ryan Reynolds' best movie. Then there's 17 films that have been tied to the Amityville name, from direct adaptations to loosely inspired spinoffs. So the Amityville Horror did not just succeed as a standalone story, it redefined the haunted house's genre. The idea that the house itself could be malevolent became a central theme, influencing countless other works of fiction, like Poltergeist or The Conjuring, borrowing heavily from the narrative structure. The tying to the haunting of real-life DeFeo martyrs, the story created a unique hybrid of true crime and supernatural horror. It's become a popular formula for horror films, documentaries, and books. The house is a visual symbol. The distinct Dutch colonial house with its quarter-circle windows resembling eyes became an iconic image synonymous with horror. Even after renovations removed the famous windows, the house remains instantly recognizable in pop culture. It introduced or popularized tropes like malevolent spirits, cursed objects, and the skeptical priest, all of which have become staples in the genre. So, the widespread media coverage of the Amityville case, combined with the popularity of the books and films, contributed to a surge of interest in paranormal investigations during the late 20th century. Organizations like the Warrens New England Society for Psychic Research gained prominence as people sought explanations for their own unexplained experiences. The case encouraged a wave of amateur ghost hunters and paranormal enthusiasts to document their own investigations, laying the groundwork for modern paranormal reality shows. Despite efforts to obscure the house's location by changing its address, 112 Ocean Avenue remains a frequent destination for horror fans and paranormal enthusiasts. Local residents and homeowners have faced waves of trespassers, forcing them to install security measures and plead for privacy. The Amityville story helped popularize the idea of haunted tourism. People travel to infamous locations tied to the supernatural or criminal events. Listen, it's okay if you just drive by it to see it. It's a neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Drive by it. Don't stop. Because with your luck, the new owners are going to shoot you. Oh, it's New York.
New York, they have very strict gun laws.
It's New York. They don't believe in guns. Skeptics argue that the Amityville Horror is a cautionary tale of how the media can blur the lines between fact and fiction. The book and subsequent films amplified the story to such a degree that it became difficult to separate the Lutz's original claims from dramatized versions. Cultural critics have suggested that the story reflects societal fears of the 1970s, including distrust of suburban safety and unease about the occult. The haunting narrative may have tapped into latent anxieties, making it resonate more deeply with audiences. As the story grew more elaborate, it became a target for parody in the media. Films like Scary Movie 2 and television shows like The Simpsons have spoofed elements of Amityville Horror, further cementing its place in pop culture. Despite the skepticism, the Lutz family story remains compelling to those who believe in the supernatural. The lack of definitive proof on either side ensures that the debate continues. Filmmakers, writers, and paranormal enthusiasts continue to draw inspiration from the Amityville Horror, ensuring its legacy remains relevant in the horror genre. The Amityville Horror symbolizes humanity's enduring fascination with the unknown, the uncanny, and the possibility of, that there may be more to the world than meets the eye. Whether viewed as a genuine haunting, a hoax, or a cultural artifact, the story of 112 Ocean Avenue continues to intrigue and terrify audiences around the globe. The Amityville Horror is far more than just a ghost story. It's a cultural phenomenon that has left an indelible mark on horror storytelling, public perceptions of the supernatural, and even the real estate market. Its legacy as a source of fear, fascination, and controversy ensures that it will continue to haunt the cultural imagination for generations to come. Whether one believes in the paranormal or not, the Amityville Horror remains an enduring tale that speaks to our deepest fears and our unrelenting curiosity about the unknown. Now, a quiet road, a mysterious light, and two missing hours. In 1961, Betty and Barney Hill claimed to have experienced something that would change the way we think about alien encounters forever. Were they taken aboard a spacecraft, or was there another explanation for their terrifying ordeal? Next time, we dive deep into one of the most famous abduction cases in history. Thank you for listening. And thank you for visiting the Scarlet Tavern. Please remember to turn in your glasses, push in your seat, and as always, tip the bard. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.